right. So this is the last class on, we've been following along with Okamura's Living by Vow. And this last class is on a chant that we do in our services, a classic Soto Zen chant called The Harmony of Difference and Sameness. And seeing as I did two podcast episodes on this, I didn't even read Okamura's chapter, although my podcast episode, like that was one of my sources, was Okamura. So if Paul can drop the little link in the chat, and then you guys can pass these out, maybe divide them into three piles for each row. We will do the chant. This is my handy dandy chart of absolute and relative,
Oh, okay.
which might be helpful. And those of you in the cloud, Paul has linked to that. Oh, and if there's an extra one, I guess I need it. Probably will be. But we will do the chant first. And that is, so we also need the link to the chant book for people. And that's on page 5 of the chant book. Thank you. All right. So let's go ahead. Did we get the chant in the chat? That the chant book? Right. So if you open that, sorry, I didn't mean to send out two links at the same time, but if you do the chant book link, the Harmony of Difference is on page 5. So I guess I'll just chant it without a mokukyo.
That's good.
All right. Harmony of difference and sameness. The great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east, while human faculties are sharp or dull. The way has no northern or southern ancestors. The true source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark, grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact, and yet do not interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its precise vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh, refined and common speech come together in the dark, clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. Four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, us with each and everything depending on these roots. A leaf spread forth, trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common. Each has its speech in the light. There is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another, like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid, principle, response, arrow, point. anoints me, hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own if you don't understand the way right before you. How will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you to study the mystery. Do not pass your days and nights in vain.
Right. So this is one of the main, like, three chants, with along with the Heart Sutra and the Precious Mirror Samadhi. That is just, you know, one of the most common chants in our lineage, and it was written by Sekito Kisen. That's the Japanese version. Shirto, I know how to pronounce his first name, kind of. Shichuan, something like that. So it was a Chinese Chan master who lived about 700 to 790. And it is about one of the most important teachings in Zen. It's about the way that reality, the one reality, reality with a capital R, appears to us to have two aspects. We experience it as having two aspects. So this little chart, because this teaching appears in many, many different places, but it uses different, like, kind of code words and poetic imagery. So sometimes you might not recognize that is what is being talked about. Generally speaking, when you see two paired terms, often likely that we're talking about that. So very briefly, just kind of go down this list of pairs so that you begin to have a sense of them. And you can recognize where it's being referred to in this harmony of difference and sameness. So difference, sameness, one of those dualities. So the Chinese, at the beginning, they actually two Chinese characters, shi or ji and li or ri. And one is the, one way to say it is the contingent and the essential. But the different paired words. So on the contingent side, sometimes it's called the relative, the aspect of reality in which each and everything is identified and defined by relative positions and qualities. So, you know, in this world, like if I'm short, that's relative to something that's tall. I'm a woman, that's compared to something that's a man. It's like, if I'm a self over here, that's because there's a skin bag over there, right? Like every way we are defined is through comparison with other things. And the pair with that is absolute, the aspect of reality in which each and everything is part of a seamless whole. I coined my own terms, dependent dimension and independent dimension, the dependent dimension being the dimension of time and space and causality, of which we're usually aware, and the independent dimension really being dimensionless, just right here, right now, boundless and without need of differentiation. There's phenomena, all that manifests and happens. And then there's principle, the truth or reality underlying or manifesting through phenomena. There's form and emptiness. And when we talk about form, that's just a shortcut for all five of the skandhas, form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, which is like in the Indian version, the sum total of our phenomenal manifestation as a person. So form and all the five skandhas, and then emptiness, the quality of all things being empty of inherent, independent, enduring self essence. We have individuality or uniqueness, the reality that no two things or moments or beings are the same. And then we have sameness, the reality that all things share the same empty nature and are part of the same seamless reality. And then an image that is often used in harmony of difference and sameness is light and dark. So in light, all things can be differentiated. And then in dark, no differentiations can be made. Then we have many myriad separateness, the countless things and beings in the universe, and then kind of one or unity. We have difference and equality. So the or difference and sameness, difference. So the relative sense in which there's important differences between things, right? Like we need to be able to discriminate between this tool and that tool and hurtful and helpful and all of that. There are differences. But then equality, the way in which all things are marked by emptiness and sameness and unity. There's interdependence and independence. This is an interesting one. Sometimes people might think to put interdependence over in the kind of one absolute column, but in a way, interdependence requires things to be dependent on each other. So there's still the multiplicity of things. Each thing is defined by its relationship to other things. But there's a sense of independence also, where each thing is just complete unto itself. So in that relative sense of like, well, it's short, small, valuable, not valuable. But when we experience things in this independent dimension, things are just complete as they are without comparison to anything. Attributes, true nature, conditional and ultimate, mundane and suchness or thusness. Mundane, the way we experience reality when we're only aware of the relative and have our fixed idea of this is ordinary, this is unworthy of attention, versus suchness or thusness, that precious luminosity of each thing in and of itself. And really, we can think about all different kinds of dualities, the divine versus the kind of worldly, perhaps the spiritual versus physical, pure versus impure, transcendent versus mundane. There's, in many religious traditions, there's a sense of being united with God and then alienated from God. There's the ideal versus the actual. So, this is something which it'd be easy to read this, chant this, talk about this tonight, and have it just seem kind of philosophical, but it really is trying to point to that tension that we feel between these different aspects of our lives, of our experience, where, I think all of us, I hope all of us, have experiences, whether that is in nature, with loved ones. I hope it's in zazen and in retreat sometime, but maybe it is, listening to beautiful music or something, or like, you touch the sublime. Oh, you witness just a, beautiful, compassionate action. Oh, you just know like everything is beautiful and, hopeful and okay. And we have a sense of that, and Then we also have our kind of everyday getting caught in our karma and, irritation and anger, or, looking out at the world and seeing terrible things happening. And there's this tension. How can both of these things be? So this teaching is really about that. I have that sense of what is greater, but it often seems distant or opposed to the mundane. And if we are identified with one aspect over the other, if we are over-identified with the relative, with the dependent dimension, we might just kind of blow off, forget about the more sublime. But if we are attached to the sublime, the independent dimension, then we might see the dependent dimension as just like a pain in the ass, right? Just a defilement, just something annoying we have to put up with, whatever. So we do tend to go one or the other. We long for more of a sense of the independent dimension, perhaps. But the Zen teaching is that these two are not separate, and one has no existence apart from the other. That this is, there's one reality, and there are different levels at which we can perceive it, different ways which we can perceive it. So the teaching, which is really focused on in this teaching poem, is the equivalence, the congruence, the accord, the identity of these two aspects. So I will end up going through this line by line, and if you don't follow, all of this is in my two-part podcast episode on this, which I, you could kind of think of as kind of like a Cliff Notes version of it. Shohaku Okamura writes beautifully about this as well. But if you kind of just want to know line by line, what's that? What is that? Because there is this poetic imagery. So to begin, the title of this, which I guess is not in our chant book, probably should be, but we have this translation, Harmony of Difference and Sameness, but the Chinese name for it is San Do Kai. So that's three different characters. And Okamura says San means many difference, diversity or variety. So that's our difference side. Used as a synonym for Ji, or that concrete phenomenal relative aspect of life. The Do means one or sameness, equality, commonality, or unity. And he says that's a synonym for the Ri, or the absolute or ultimate reality of emptiness beyond discrimination. And then this I thought was totally cool. So then he says the Kai is a promise, agreement, or tally. And he explains that in ancient times, merchants wrote a contract on a tally, a piece of wood, and then broke it in half. And so they could later confirm the agreement because the two pieces would fit together. So one would take one piece, one would take the other. So, like, absolute and relative then are like two halves of one thing. So I like the title translation of the title better, the identity of relative and absolute, because of that idea. Harmony to me sounds like they're two different things and they get along, whereas identity is pointing toward more toward this, like they're not different to begin with. And my long version of the title is the apparently paradoxical fact that absolute and relative are intimately related and mutually dependent. So, to get on to line by line, and feel free to raise hands or make comments at any point. So the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. So the mind of the great sage of India is Shakyamuni Buddha, and the mind is the essence of his teaching, intimately transmitted teacher to student. So there's this Zen Chan tradition of this is a face-to-face transmission. It's not just something you learn from a book. And it's from west to east. It's from India to China. So the point is to emphasize that this Dharma is passed down unchanged, so that you and I have the opportunity to encounter this same teaching. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. So this refers to a, it's somewhat mythical, but in China, there was kind of a understanding or, yeah, this sectarian story that kind of you could, if you had duller faculties, you can practice gradual practice, gradually working your way toward enlightenment, maybe over lifetimes. And that was predominantly like in the north, right? So that's the nor nor a northern ancestor would be the gradual practice. But if you were sharp, then you could do this, Chan practice. You could practice with koans or something, and have this awakening, this sudden awakening. Which in our, I mean, so when it says the way has no northern or southern ancestors, so it's saying that's gradual, sudden does not apply. That's not part of our deal. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. So, Ri or absolute is the spiritual source. So, the spiritual source, so this absolute shines clear in the light. Now, the light is where everything is discriminated. So, this, and it would seem like the opposite, right? The spiritual source should shine clear in the dark, right? But it shines clear in the light, and the branching streams, which is another, like this is the multiplicity of things, they flow on in the dark. So even when nothing is being differentiated, though that dif those differences are still there. So even within the relative, the absolute shines unimpeded, even if it may not be evident. And in some ways, I think about like the stars are shining even when it's daytime and it's bright and we can't see them, right? And the so even when, and then the relative phenomena continue functioning without obstruction, even along the independent dimension. The two aspects don't interfere and are always present. So grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness, is still not enlightenment. So grasping at things is surely delusion. That's pretty obvious. We know about that part. But according with sameness is still not enlightenment. So this is really pointing out where, we have these these different paired things, terms describing our the kind of dual nature of our experience. It is important in our practice that we develop a deeper relationship with the essential, with the absolute, with the independent dimension of things, to have a sense of it, to develop a personal conviction. But that's not that that is real. That is superior, some superior realm. And then, we try to avoid the dependent dimension or something. Like that's the good, the pure, the good, and the rest of it is just kind of to be avoided. So this is an actual, like they call it the Zen sickness, where if you do have some conviction, and doesn't have to be just through Zen. Sometimes people get this insight other ways, but a sense of how, like, wow, everything is empty, and in a way, nothing really matters, and whatever. And they can begin, what do I want to say, living inappropriately, because they're denying the dependent dimension, they're denying the relative. So, for instance, you may have a insight, right, of like, in a way, there's no death and no life. And then when your friend is experiencing a family loss and you say, in a way, there's no death, no life, right? That would be you're stuck in your absolute realm and you're forgetting like how to act appropriately in life. And so we can get attached to that other side. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. So all the stuff, all the things defined by relative positions and relationships are interdependent by nature. And yet, in a sense, so we could say they're always like interdependent and interacting. And yet there's a set if in the sense in which they don't exist the way we think they do, they don't have independent existence, then you can't be saying that this is interacting with this. Like it in a sense, it's all just part of one seamless reality. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. Again, that's that pointing toward when in this one seamless reality, everything just at any given moment, exactly where it is just complete in its own being. Just look and see an ant crawling up the blade of grass. There it is. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So, in the realm of differentiation, there's different kinds of things, different kinds of sights. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. There is an aspect to to reality in which none of these things are differentiated. And yet, in the there, then in the light, we tell the difference. We can't and shouldn't deny reality, the reality of the relative, but it's valuable to have the larger perspective so we don't get so knocked around by conditions. The four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. So the four elements, fire, wind, water, earth, they return to their natures. So they're all empty. And emptiness is potential. So sometimes it's described as like a mother, like the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom of emptiness is the mother of all Buddhas. So out of that potential comes everything. So they return in a sense to their emptiness, and yet, there's also the aspect in which they have these different qualities. So it's not that we look out and see things, and the things are actually empty. So I look at this thing, and it doesn't have a self nature. It doesn't have a self nature. Or that despite emptiness, despite that nothing really exists, there just appears to be things. So both of those things are setting up like this is a thing that either does or doesn't have a self nature. It's still setting up kind of two separate realities in a dualistic way, as if emptiness kind of delegitimizes form somehow. where nothing really exists, they're merely illusions. But in reality, and this has also gotten at the Heart Sutra, form and emptiness are not opposed to each other. Just as there is no child without a mother or a mother without a child, emptiness defines things and things define emptiness. Emptiness doesn't exist somewhere on its own. It is a quality of things. No things, no emptiness. Therefore, at the same time as all things lack inherent enduring self-nature, they manifest the wondrous differences of the phenomenal world in their function and characteristics. So because of emptiness, fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. Thus, with each and everything depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. So how does the world get to be the way it is? We like to imagine that there's, you know, some kind of intelligent process back there that's kind of good or bad and, you know, is pushing things on its way. But from the Zen point of view, behind it all is emptiness. Every phenomenon arises from causes, which themselves were simply resultant phenomena. Thus, through the interactions of myriad things, we arrive at the present situation. Ultimately, there is no one, no thing to be credited or blamed. From the absolute perspective, it's just leaves spreading. There's bindweed growing on the boulevard in front of my house. I need to yank it back or it would take over my whole yard. There it is. Just one cause leading to another. And that's from the absolute point of view in a way, right? Like just kind of a dispassionate way of seeing how things unfold. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common, each has its speech. So trunk is the absolute, and the branches are the relative, but they're part of the same thing. Once again, just another image. But our experience of them is still different, and they have their own expression in the world. So we experience the relative has a certain kind of feeling, and we experience the absolute as a certain kind of experience. Not using one to oppose the other, or each had when that sense each has its speech. That's again that example of not trying to give an absolute answer to a relative problem, or a relative answer to an absolute problem. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. So according to Shunryu Suzuki, who also wrote about this, this could be translated as light has darkness and darkness has light, like we have hands. So I really love that image, like rather than, you know, in the light, there is darkness, but just light has darkness. Darkness has light. They're intimate and inseparable. And another image associated with this is the yin yang symbol, right? Like light, but there's dark within it, dark within the light. But don't, this interesting thing of like, but don't take it as darkness and don't see it as light. Because once again, then we're creating a separation, right? We're like, here I am in the middle of that dang, you know, relative realm, but there's a little glow of the absolute. And we're still seeing it as different when we do experience it as it feels different. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about all this stuff, right? Otherwise, there wouldn't be any need for a teaching about it. But what Zen's pointing us toward is it looks different, but it is not. Try to see in what way these two things are actually interpenetrate. And another image for this, very famous one, light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. I mean, this is really beautiful, profound stuff that can lead to a, I don't know, it's a very grounded, flexible acceptance of this world. I'm not saying that in order for life to function, there has to be, murder and injustice. That's just thinking. And yet, this limited world that we embody by being a human being, by being in a body, by being in a life, by having a lifespan, by getting older, by, having to work and deal with aches and pains, and all of this is like the beauty would not exist without this. This is not a, like an imperfect container for the divine. This is not an obstruction to it. Like, we would not experience the sublime except this way. Each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. We kind of talked about that. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. So more images of a G and Re fitting together like a box and its lid, perfectly responding to each other like two arrows meeting in midair. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. Setting up standards of your own means intellectualizing, conceptualizing this teaching instead of practicing it. But this is an irony we face in practice. We can't experience the rewards of practice simply by listening to and memorizing these teachings. They don't give us anything. Okay, sure, whatever. There's two different aspects and they're one thing, I mean, it might be a little fun intellectually, but it doesn't really, provide much relief or satisfaction. So that's obviously true. But on the other hand, we might even say, well, I'm just gonna sit. I'm just gonna sit, and I don't need to study and intellectualize all this stuff. And that's probably better than just intellectualizing, but we also need the teachings in order to expand our minds and challenge us. So we study, we over-intellectualize, we practice, kind of let it sink in, go back to the teachings. Like, so kind of over-intellectualizing, setting up standards of our own is like just a hazard of the practice. We will do that. It's just reminding us not to get stuck there. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? I always just took great inspiration from this line because sometimes it seems like the Dharma is asking us to, I don't know, to develop some other kind of perception, some other kind of understanding to transcend our limited being, to see all this amazing stuff, these teachings, to get insights, whatever. And it can feel other than here. But if you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Like, we can trust our own direct experience. And in fact, that's the only thing that we can do. So we don't have to worry about like what's out there. Just, you know, one step. And progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. So we can be told from the beginning, there's nowhere to get. It's right here. The piece is just completely right here. And sometimes we might be closer to that than others, but then sometimes it seems like there's mountains and rivers in our way. If it seems far, we're confused. There's no obstruction except for what we create for ourselves. Still, sometimes there we are in the middle of our obstructions, and it's not necessarily so easy just to drop them or see past them. And I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. There's so much more to experience for all of us. We can be wiser, freer, more compassionate. What does it mean to pass our days and nights in vain? And what is the relevance of the Sandokai for us right now? I think for me, there's still, I mean, the production of dukkha becomes more and more subtle with practice. But we can still carry just a sense that this is not it. This is not it. That was it. or we may think, I've never experienced that. You know, this is not it. And I've never even tasted that thing they're talking about that's so supposedly so great. Or we have a taste of it. And then we're like, well, it's not here. It's not here right now. So this is really challenging that whole assumption. It's like, it's all right before us. So I will leave it there. Any questions or comments? Yoli, you want to come up?
Yeah, I just have a question about the, I still didn't quite understand the line. It just the second line, while human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. Can you just go over that?
So that was again? The if you have dull faculties, you need to do gradual practice, and gradual practice would be, you know, precepts, moral, you know, working on yourself morally, our karma work, right? Your bad habits, trying to let go of anger. And, you know, and this was a very original Buddhism. When you look back and hear how the Buddha recommended his monks practice, they were talking about purifying themselves over lifetimes, right? To working very hard to let go of you know, reactivity, to let go of this desire, to let go of this. It was a long process of transformation. And so, you know, the idea would be that you work on yourself until you attain something over lifetimes. And then the Zen point of view was like, you can drop it right now. Like we're creating our own obstruction right now. So in this moment, we can drop it. Now, both are true. In our practice, we do both, not just one or the other. If we did only the kind of gradual, we'd be kind of missing the point, the most liberating teachings. But if we just focused on, well, let's all just sit session waiting until we have some kind of great insight, then who cares how you act in your everyday life? Who cares if you integrate what you see on the cushion into your behavior? Like, well, what would be the point of that, right? So we do both. So that's why this kind of stereotype of like the Northerners did this gradual practice, the Southerners did this sudden enlightenment stuff, and that this saying like that's this way has no Northern or Southern ancestors. Leah.
So this line seems pretty darn abstract. I'm having trouble understanding. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise, each keeps its place. Something about the nature of reality and things, I don't help.
I mean, there's probably different ways to interpret this, but I'm thinking of all of those in the realm of discrimination and multiplicity, right? And there's all the things.
Yes.
And all the things are interdependent and affecting each other and on this whole like chain of causation. On the other side, each keeps its place. In a way, even if they're interacting, because in this other, along this other dimension of reality, which is not a different reality, right? But there's another, also a way in which if we're all part of one thing, then I mean, in a way, it doesn't even make sense to say each keeps its own place if it's not a separate thing. And yet that is how we experience it. When we are really just seeing things without our mental map. When I hold up a coffee mug, it's in its own place. I don't even have to think coffee mug. It's just there it is. It's just shiny.
This is reminding me of that time you were describing the nature of the world and everything in it, and then all doing all the world things and all the people doing their people things, and then it was almost like you could hit the pause button and just stop.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, because the in this I mean I'm in the independent dimension, which is not considering space and time and causality and whatever. Yeah, things don't actually stop, right? But in this moment, yeah. So I for those who hadn't heard this one, I said, I don't know, for some reason it kind of helps me with this image of like, yeah, you've got all of this stuff going on in the world, and if you could just hit a pause button and then wander around, and there'd be like, and there's the car and there's the stoplight and there's all this stuff. It's just like, even though like by definition things are defined relatively speaking, and obviously they're all interacting, but in a way in this along this dimension they're just occupying their own space. Thanks for reminding me of that. Candy.
So the thing I'm on this line that says light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. I think what's tripping me up here is, to me, well, the front and back foot don't stay the front and back foot. Like the front one becomes the back, and the back one becomes the front one. So it's this saying that light and dark, like, are interchangeable. Like, is that what this is? I don't know. It's kind of
Yeah, I
weird.
think so. I think
Oh, okay.
yeah.
All right.
Like they have to they need one another
I
to
mean, they're not the
function.
same, that because in the moment of them, like you trying to walk, one is doing one thing and one is doing the
Yeah.
other, right? But then, like, the next step, they like the other one becomes the other thing and does the
Yeah.
other thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I was like, is that what this is saying? Like,
I think so. I never really thought about the kind of dynamic quality of that image, but I think you're right on with that, in the sense that and that's our experience of life too, is that this kind of the mundane comes forward, and the divine comes forward, and the mundane comes forward, and
oh,
yeah,
okay. All right. This isn't okay. I was just like, is
yeah.
that what it's saying? It doesn't, I want to say it doesn't make sense, but I was like, no, but okay. Cool. But that's because we're not supposed to see this light and darkness. That's why I would be confused if I read the other sentences. Yeah.
Does it seem more relevant now? I mean, if you're anything like me, though, like I mean, I can look at this now, okay, because I studied this today, and I go, that's the four elements, and but then, like, I don't know, a month from now, I'll be chanting, and I'll be like, what was that again? I don't know, but I had this faith that, like, well, I studied it once, and it made sense, and so, you know, I get the general gist. What it means.
Yeah, I feel like that's what I have right now. I feel like I have a general gist about what I use.
John.
Domiel, thanks for this. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the profundity. You're sitting on the cushion, and all of a sudden, you have an experience that this harmony of difference and sameness, just like, oh my gosh. I mean, can you talk about the experience of seeing it both ways at once?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because the other poem that we regularly recite, the Precious Mirror Samadhi, is about another teaching that is about, like, the absolute and relative, but it's almost more, it's a later teaching, and it's a little bit more, I don't know about more nuanced, but what it's about is five stages of practice, and a kind of our relationship to absolute and relative. And at first, we really only see the relative. We don't even know anything. We don't, doesn't even occur to us that there's another way of experiencing life. Then we get a sense there should be something more. We hear the teachings, we have some intuition, we have an insight or something in that, but the absolute seems very elusive, right? It just shines through at certain times. And then there's a stage where, like, we really, really have more of a sense of the independent dimension. Really more of a, like, yeah, I you know, I think I'm getting this. I mean, not again, it's never something you get, right? And, like, can understand, but you're starting to have a personal experience of it. And that's very then that's like the absolute really comes to the fore. But there's still then, like, a sense of, like, oh, I have this experience. Then I go back to the relative. Then I go to session again, and then I go back to the relative. Or, you know, I have a nice zazen period, and then I go back to the relative, right? So it feels very front and back foot and walking, right? It feels very kind of disjointed, and we may hear these things that they're intimately related and all that, but it's a whole nother stage of practice to really start to integrate that, to, all right, what does that mean? How does this relate to this? Really, and it's the longest stage of practice, if you will. It's often uncomfortable. It's kind of gritty. But it comes from really even more radically questioning our assumptions about this life. And basically, Zen's always asking us to, like, whatever view you hold, let go of it. Whatever view you hold, let go of it. So even that sense of, like, there's two different things, just like let go of it. And more than just, walking down the grocery aisle, it's no different than, sitting on the cushion in the middle of session, which is just lovely. It's like that kind of sense of kind of coming home to ourselves and not being so disconnected, not as much tension. So I would say that kind of integration and seeing more together isn't kind of a sitting on the cushion amazing experience. It's more of like a day-to-day, moment-to-moment. Yeah. Does that answer your question at all?
Are there any answers? Thank
Yes.
you.
All right. Well, we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for
Bye,
coming.
everyone.
Have a good
Bye.
sabbatical, Domio.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Oh.